The Scouted podcast is brought to you with the support of our friends at Skill Corner, whose tracking data and performance analytics are used by many of the top clubs, leagues, and federations around the world. Covering a wide range of global competitions, Skill Corner's data helps customers to make faster, better informed decisions in recruitment, player development, and strategy. And we are now using it to support our own analysis of up and coming talent. For more information, visit skillcorner.com. Hello, welcome back to the Scouted podcast with me, Joe Donoghue. Today I'm joined by a man very experienced in the field of recruitment and academy development. Newly appointed Chicago Fire Sporting Director Greg Broughton joins me in the virtual studio. Greg has worked with a number of clubs in the UK, as well as with Norwegian side Bodø Glimt, who many of you may remember as the club from within the Arctic Circle, who beat Jose Mourinho's Roma 6-1 in Europe and romped to consecutive titles a couple of years ago with a hearty crop of players they produced themselves. Well, Greg was the academy manager there for several years. More recently, though, he spent time at Blackburn Rovers as their sporting director in the Championship, as well as positions at Luton Town and Norwich City prior to his spell in Norwegian football. Greg, welcome to the Scouted podcast, and thank you for agreeing to be here. How's it going?
Yeah, it's really good, thanks, Joe. Just trying to keep warm in this Arctic weather we're having in the north of England at the moment.
Yeah, it is. It's definitely translated into to fleece weather these past couple of days, hasn't it? We'll just start with your new opportunity, your new role. In the past week or so, you've been announced as the sporting director at Chicago Fire. How are you finding the early knockings of that role?
Yeah, just in preparation mode really at the moment because of the visa situation. So waiting for the paperwork to be confirmed to allow me to officially go and work in the USA. But I think it's just such an exciting project. I think the club is one of the sleeping giants of North American sport. I think everything's in place in terms of the structure built at the club, a brand new training ground open in January to really take off. And obviously the benchmark is set high because of the sporting success that Chicago as a city expects from all of the other major sports. And our job now is to try and put Chicago Fire amongst those greats.
Yeah, absolutely. It's certainly one of the first Major League Soccer clubs that comes to mind when I think about MLS, and particularly from the 90s, the inaugural seasons and the early 2000s as well. But of course, you know, your background in the game has been, you know, this side of the pond, shall we say, and as well as in Europe as well. What were your sort of your earliest forays into, you know, the world of recruitment, the world of academy management? What was that sort of background like for you?
Yeah, funnily enough, it started back in America. So after graduating, or even whilst I was at university, I spent a lot of time working on the summer camps, as a lot of kind of coaches do, just getting hours under the belt on the grass in really extreme heats and all kind of challenging situations. And that kind of shaped you in terms of the number of hours you were able to get under your belt and really try and test some of your coaching theories in that environment. And I had a kind of a choice to make at that stage as to whether to try and stay in America and work within that club environment. But I had the opportunity to come back to the UK full-time to work for Rushden and Diamonds initially, which was an unbelievable learning ground. I see it as a real apprenticeship if I think about some of the people I was able to work under at Rushden and Diamonds. So Brian Talbot was very much the manager of the club, an old-fashioned manager, and he'd come from Arsenal with all of those great things that had happened at that club, and he'd been part of that and part of the England setup. And then working under him was Terry Wesley as a first-team coach, who was a great player developer, unbelievable coach, and has obviously gone on to be a manager, a leading academy manager, working for the Premier League. Also, at that time, Barry Hunter, who's now obviously head of the recruitment department at Liverpool. He was club captain and then manager, head coach, and really good learning opportunity to see how he thought of development of players as well. And finally, Jeff Harrop, who was the head of youth development at that stage as well, and has gone on to work for Southampton and many other clubs. Now, ironically, back at one of my old clubs at Norwich City, helping them out there. So I think that was my apprenticeship was the 6 years at Russian and Diamonds.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like a really holistic environment where you kind of got you're able to get your hands on various different areas, and you know, as you say, a real grounding. You know, your roles at Luton and your roles at Norwich, you know, as academy manager, you know, they were, you know, around 15 years ago. What has changed for you and from your vantage point in the last 15 years in sort of the recruitment field or the academy fields that has been the most, I don't know, wide ranging?
Without a doubt, ECCC, although that was brought in 2012, I think the ramifications of that are still rumbling through the system. Even if you look at this summer and some of the quite unusual moves in English football where young players are moving for £20 million without ever playing in the Premier League and barely kicking a ball in the Championship. And ECCC was really the beginning of that formalisation of player valuations within the youth sector. I think at Luton, it was very much a case of trying to help rebuild the academy after severe financial restraints upon the club had meant enormous cutbacks. And we tried to tackle that by targeting recruitment in the youth development phase, kind of 12 to 14, but also being really, really proactive in the pre-academy with 8 and 9 year olds as well. When I went to Norwich, it was very much a different challenge in 2012. So ECCC had just started. Norwich had pushed really, really hard to be amongst those first category one clubs. But again, it was only 2 years previous that the club had been in League One. So joining a Premier League club from what was a non-league club in terms of Luton status at that stage was a huge change for me. But I think from a recruitment point of view, we had to be very, very precise because resources were limited. And that's where I began to work with data very much for the first time. So we brought in Jason Ito to work with us on a work placement. And Jason was brilliant for us. He was only with us for a year and it's no surprised to go on and see the success he's now had at Arsenal. And Jason helped us do a very precise piece of work on UK recruitment to decide what boroughs within the south of England we were going to put our resources in. And we kind of chose 4 or 5 boroughs where we threw all of our resources into those boroughs in terms of talent ID, in terms of coaching, and especially within London, which going into London itself as a city was something Norwich hadn't done before. And we put centres and recruitment staff into key areas there, managed by two guys, Jay Marshall, Ryan Gordon. And that helped the club now. And it's only recently now, despite that work starting in 2012, you're now seeing the benefits of that. So obviously Norwich were able to sell Jonathan Rowe this summer, Abu Kamara this summer, and players like that that have come through that system, which began with Jason's piece of work in terms of the ID and then the work that Jay and Ryan were doing in the field.
Do you find that it's sometimes, I mean, it takes an extensive amount of time? I mean, you see with, you know, the England national team and the performance that they've managed to oversee over the past couple of tournaments in particular, you know, I think a lot of people are starting to begin to see the reaping of the rewards from, you know, developing St. George's Park. Do you find that at a smaller level, you know, like a Norwich, for example, that you've, I don't know, it does take so long to actually begin to reap those rewards. And I don't know, is there a willingness to be patient from you know, the powers that be of football clubs to be able to see that?
You have to have stable ownership and you have to have ownership that are solely focused on that. And Norwich were lucky. They had Delia Smith until very, very recently. And Delia was absolutely unequivocal in terms of her demands of the academy as a core part of the club. And because of that, then the club were able to reap those rewards. But it wasn't easy. In fact, one of my biggest challenges, I think, in my career was probably 2015, 2016. I felt we had a really, really good crop of players. They'd just won the FA Youth Cup in 2013. But we couldn't get the Murphys into the team. We couldn't get Carlton Morris, Harry Toffolo, Cam McGee and Cam Norman. All of these players that have gone on to play in the Premier League and Championship regularly, we couldn't get them anywhere near. And one of the reasons for that was there was such a high demand to try and stay in the Premier League, which I completely understand. But I felt we weren't quite aligned in terms of the long-term picture. And it took the work that Stuart Webber did then to come into the club and to bring in a head coach that really, really believed and gave those players an opportunity. And obviously, yes, there were some financial means that meant the club had to at that stage as well. But after years of being told the club wasn't producing players and there weren't players good enough, you sometimes begin to question your own ability to judge talent and to judge potential. That was certainly the case at that stage at Norwich, because, like I said, that group that were bubbling, that were born 1995, and then we had kind of Jamal Lewis, Max Ahrens, Todd Cantwell, all of those players, again, knocking on the door, but nowhere near. So sometimes you have to realign things within the club, and that's what the club were able to do, and then won the championship twice in that period based upon a team with that young group of players at the core of that team.
Yeah, obviously a very, very successful time for Norwich. And obviously you look at the players in those squads who, you know, did have their roots from, you know, London boroughs. So obviously the work that went into that, you know, several years prior, obviously is very instructive as to how that success came about. In terms of moving to Norway, because that's such an interesting move, you know, at the time that you did, especially given the way that it coincided with Glimt's, you know, they're rising from the, you know, the second tier in Norway, almost being relegated and then going and becoming back-to-back champions. You know, it is, I know it was described at the time in, you know, certain outlets that it was, you know, Norway's own Leicester City story. I'd be curious to know your outlook on how that was portrayed at the time, certainly in the English media, but also from a sense of, you know, your role, how hands-on, you know, the academy structure was, how difficult it was, and how cathartic it then proved to be to see, you know, the likes of Ulrik Saltnes, you know, Patrick Berg with his family connections, Jens Petter Hauge, all those sorts of players coming to the fore, and ultimately delivering success.
Yeah, I think, look, in terms of how that came about, towards the end of my time at Norwich, I was really, really focused on wanting to experience life and work abroad. And my preferred choice was Scandinavia. We'd done a lot of work in Scandinavia through my time at Norwich. I'd travelled extensively through the area. And I had an opportunity to speak to Bodø Glimt. And you could just see from those early conversations how well structured the club was behind the scenes. They had absolute clarity on their mission, their values. All of the hard culture work had been done. And the guy that I succeeded into the job, Øyvind Iversen, who's a brilliant mind, one of the great thinkers of Norwegian football, had been headhunted by the Norwegian FA to go and drive the academy program throughout the country. And I think you're seeing now some of the success of that in terms of the young players around the Norway squad. Nusa was one who's hitting the headlines in the games in the last international break. So I think I felt that everything was in the place for the club to achieve its aim, which was to become a stable top-level club in Norway, because it had never done that. It had always been a club bouncing between the top two divisions. It had periods itself of financial trouble. But if you looked throughout the Norway youth teams at that stage, there were Glimt players in all of those age groups doing well, who were on the verges of the first team. When I joined, a lot of them had already made debuts for the first team, but by no means regulars in the starting 11. So coinciding with me joining the club at the end of 2017, Kjetil Knudsen was promoted from first team coach to manager, or from assistant coach to first team coach, depending upon how you define the structure. And I think it took a lot of bravery from the club to do that move, but it also shows the lack of ego of the people involved, because Osman Bjørkan was the manager or head coach at that stage, and he accepted stepping into a different role to let Kjetil drive the club going forwards. And that move was really the pivotal move that's allowed the club to drive forward to now. 2018, my first full year, obviously Norway has a summer season, but 2018, the club had struggled. Results maybe weren't what everybody thought they should be. Kjetil himself, I think, was under pressure from the local media. And the message we tried to communicate internally to the board, because we started using data for the first time, was performances were actually okay. We weren't maybe finishing as many chances as we were creating, maybe Sheffield hadn't been able to evolve the squad enough in terms of the attacking players to develop the game model he wanted to bring in or bring onto the club. But underlying performance levels were okay. And I think of the bottom six clubs in the Eliteserien that year, Bodø/Glimt were the only club not to change the manager. They stayed with the process, stayed with everything. And then 2019, things really took off and the club finished second. And then COVID hit. And COVID hit, obviously, end of February, March 2020. And the Norwegian season hadn't even started at that stage. So that was a really, really difficult period because some people thought the season might never start. Obviously, the world had gone into complete turmoil. No one knew what was going to happen. And a lot of Norwegian clubs at that stage furloughed their playing staff and their coaching staff because clubs aren't run with huge budgets. And money's tight in Norwegian football. Some clubs, because they were worried that the FIFA regulation in terms of freedom of contract might come into play, only furloughed the least valuable players in the squad and kept the others. So it was a really difficult situation. And I was part of a group along with a player leadership group and Ørjan Berg, a legendary player within Bodø/Glimt, who kind of went to the board and said, whatever we do, if we can, don't furlough anybody. Nobody gets furloughed from the club. We all agree to take a percentage cut in our pay for 3 months to try and get us through to the end of May. Let's reassess the situation then, but let's try and keep business as normal as it can be despite these extraordinary circumstances. And what that allowed the club to do was to have an unbelievable preparation period for the 2020 season. So most clubs got a 3-week notice the season was going to start. We'd had a 3-month lead into that period, and I think we won the first 10 games of the season and were unplayable that year. And then obviously went on to play Milan and go toe-to-toe in the San Siro in a one-legged European game because of the circumstances, and were very, very unlucky to lose the game 3-2. And that team was really built around the core of young players who'd then broken into the group. So Ulrik was the oldest of those young players, but Patrick, Fredrik Bjørken, Håkon Evjen, Jens-Petter Hauge were all around the team at that stage. And that was fantastic to see.
I mean, that was around that time. I mean, I know that a lot of us had scouted. We did follow how Glimt were playing, and obviously knowing now that the background to that season. I mean, was it something you won 26 of the 30 league games that year? Knowing the background of, you know, having that lead up, and ultimately it came down to, you know, what was a business decision that ultimately has then translated, or at least contributed in a way, to, you know, extraordinary success, is really fascinating.
Yeah, and again, it just really shows the quality of the board and the quality of the ownership model, not just in Bodø/Glimt but in Norwegian football as well, which allows real stability within a club. And like I said, that's just a tiny, tiny part of the reason that they've had success. All of the foundations had been built for 10 years prior to that, many, many years before I joined the club. So I think really, really good people aligned, thinking, aiming and working towards one value. And I think Ulrik's a really, really interesting player to talk about because at that stage when I joined the club, he was a player who wasn't really in the team as a starting 11 player, had almost considered walking away from football because he'd become disillusioned with it. And one of the guys who's still a leading part of the club, Håvard Zachariassen, had reached out to a mental trainer who worked with the Norwegian Air Force, because the Norwegian Air Force at that stage had a base within Bodø, and began talking to a guy called Bjørn Mansvak, who was a ex-Air Force pilot and had now become a mental trainer within the Norwegian Air Force, and just said to him, is there any chance he could come and talk to Ulrik? So they started talking, and he tried to reconnect Ulrik with his passion for football as a young man. Why did you play football as 13, 14? Because you love it. You, if your parents let you, you'd stay out until midnight playing. And he'd lost that joy, and he tried to reconnect him with that, and it really transformed Ulrik's career. But I also believe that moment transformed Bodø/Glimt as a football club as well, because the other players began to see that Ulrik's performances went from there to here, to here, to here. And they were like, well, what's happening here? So more and more players began to work with Bjørn. And eventually the club reached out and said, would you work with the whole group? And he said, well, only on several conditions. Firstly, that I'm not the agent of the club. If players speak to me, that will never go back to you as the club unless they say that they want me to do that. And secondly, that the coaching team completely buy into that process as well, because I can't be working against the coaching team. It has to be hand in hand. And the coaching team have to be able to park their egos enough to accept that there might be feedback from these sessions that they don't want to hear. And if they're brave enough to take that on, then I'm brave enough to take the challenge on. And what it really allowed the club to do then was to evolve its playing style even further, to show a real bravery and dominance in possession and be able to go toe-to-toe. You've already touched on the game against Mourinho with Roma, but even more recently, like this season, or in the last couple of months, they played Porto in the Europa League at home, were down to 10 men, 2-1 down, and just kept attacking and went on the front foot, despite Porto being this giant of European football. And Björn's work within the club has been monumental, along with Schettl's coaching. And some of the foundation work that the academy had put in many years under Øyvind Iversen to help develop the group to where it is today. But it's a phenomenal story and one that really changed my way of thinking about football and my outlook on the game. So,
yeah, I mean, as I say, it's fascinating to hear it from your perspective, from being, you know, within that structure or the apparatus that was there at Buda at the time. You know, I think a lot of the time people just think that, okay, if you can plug and play a manager who's been successful somewhere, then it's immediately going to translate across and that success is going to be replicable. But that, you know, that you're forgetting, or rather those people are forgetting, that, you know, it's not simply as black and white as that. You have to have the structure, as you mentioned, at boardroom level. You have to have the right personalities and everybody in reserve, or in sort of the behind the scenes roles, you know, like you're saying about Björn Mansfjord there. I mean, yourself in the academy side of things, the sort of the moving across of Osman Bjorkan, and of course Jettel as well. It's fascinating to hear. You know, you touched on data, and when referencing the season where it was maybe a little bit tricky, where Bodø finished 11th in the Eliteserien, and I think sometimes it can be used. I think sometimes managers can, or coaches can use data as a crutch. You know, say, "Oh, look, it's not as bad as it could be," but then on the other side of things, you know, there are issues at play. There are greater issues at play that mean that the data it certainly comes secondary. Have you found it in your experience difficult sometimes to explain or relay those data, I don't know, findings to individuals who maybe are a little bit more senior at clubs, who maybe don't have that background, and who are ultimately on the hook for the big decisions and the performance of the club? You know, is there a difference in approach when, you know, there's data at play?
Yeah, I think that it ultimately comes down to the ownership of the group. If they buy into data and they're prepared to realize that data can really help you look beneath the surface of performance, then I don't think there's any issue with that whatsoever. I don't think there's any coincidence that the success of the poster boys of British football right now in terms of Brentford and Brighton, their owners are both heavily centered around data. Yeah. And if that isn't the case, then I think it's always going to be very, very hard, because it's just used or can be thrown back to you as an excuse or a get out or whatever. So I think it goes back to that initial conversation. It's how aligned is your football club to its mission statement? And if your club is completely aligned in terms of how it feels it should operate, both on the football and the business side of the organization, then data and communicating data becomes no issue. But if that alignment isn't there, then it becomes very, very challenging.
Mm. Just going back to, you know, your time with Glimt more specifically, obviously the logistical challenges of, you know, being with a club in, you know, situated in the Arctic Circle, even though, you know, you have the seasons in Norway, which are, you know, from April to November? Am I right in thinking?
Yeah.
Obviously during the Northern Hemisphere summer, it's still very difficult given the links. I mean, how long it takes to fly from, you know, the south of Norway to the north, and from your side of things, you know, with recruitment and academy development and stuff like that, you know, how difficult is it to lure players there, and how much of a reliance do you have to have on the immediate, you know, local populace to basically build, you know, the academy sides for that club?
Yeah, look, initially it was very, very difficult because the club hadn't got a body of success there. So to attract non-North Norwegian players to the club was a challenge. But I think the club, that's because the club's developed so much, that's become easier and easier. I think also the club was prepared to look in markets where maybe that wasn't an issue. So I think one of the great pieces of transfer business the club did, and again, credit completely down to Osman Bjørkan for this one, but bringing in Victor Boniface from Nigeria at the age of 18, who'd never seen snow before, and to throw him into that environment, and then to support him through two cruel injuries and to allow him to regain his place in the team, and now obviously one of the top 10 strikers in European football. I think you have to just be prepared to shop in markets where players are prepared to come and take that challenge on for you. Specifically from an academy recruitment point of view, it was a challenge because the north of Norway is a huge place. To the south of us, you were traveling 7 to 8 hours by car to Brunnesund, which was the little town in the south of Norland, the county, which is where Ulrik Sodnes came from. And then if you were driving up to the tip of Finnmark, which is where kind of Norway joins the Russian border, that's a 20-hour drive. But there's players from there like Morten Gams Pedersen, Stefan Johansson, are all from Finnmark at the top of the country. So good footballers were coming from that area. So you had to try and devise a program that would allow you to see that talent, to allow them to continue to develop in their club environment, maybe till 16, and then also to bring them in. So one of the things we tried to do towards the end of my time at Glimt was we partnered with PlayerMaker, the technology group. It's the Israeli technology company where the unit is worn upon the boot. And we would give these units out to players that we'd identified all across the north of Norway and try and educate their club in terms of the use of the data that this unit was giving them. And it also allowed us to look at their training loads, give them technical feedback on their sessions, etc. as well. And that became one way of doing the outreach. But the partnerships with the clubs in the north of Norway was absolutely vital. If you didn't have good partnerships with those clubs, it would become very, very difficult. So communication, supporting their travel. We used to have weekends where under 14 or under 16, if you had national games, the players would come in from the partner clubs to support you in that national games program. And on a Friday night, players would be arriving by train, by aeroplane, by ferry, by car. Sometimes the snow would be so thick that half of those transport modes would disappear overnight. So it was a challenge. But I think it was a worthwhile challenge because of the players that you've seen come through the program.
Yeah, absolutely. I could only echo that from the success that Glimt obviously had as a result at all levels, not just at that first team level. Because as you say, you know, now there's a bedrock of success there. It's kind of like there is now a North Norwegian academy of note. To speak of. So a very, very, very successful story, very very good story in the plethora of bad stories in modern football. Fascinating to hear what you had to say on it. Returning to the UK with Blackburn, the opportunity to become a sporting director, at an historic club like Blackburn, that obviously had not been going through the best of times in its recent history. Coming in there, what were the immediate challenges that you found, and what were the immediate differences from your role with Glimt compared with that coming in at Blackburn?
Very, very different to Glimt. A fantastic club with great heritage, a fantastic supporter base who demand success because of the not only the historic success of the very, very early days of football in England, but also the more recent success. I think when we spoke with the supporters group and tried to do some of the values work with the club, one of the things that came through was, although the club was obviously very, very proud of the success under Jack Walker and the period in the 90s, they were equally proud of the period under Souness and Hughes, where they felt they were overachieving during that period of success then during the 2000s. So I think the first and the biggest challenge is I came into the job the first week of June in 2022, and we didn't have a coach. Tony Mowbray had left a month earlier, and I think Tony and his staff had done an unbelievable job at the club, had built great foundations. The club, the squad was in a really, really good place. And I think one of the criticisms aimed at the club at that stage was players had been allowed to leave who were under contract or whose contracts had expired too easily. And you'd seen Rothwell and Lenahan and others leave in that period. So I think the two big challenges for me going into the job straight away was obviously the head coach, but also to ensure that we were really, really proactive on contract renewal, to ensure that if we were going to generate a player trading model, which was one of the aims that we'd set out for the club, we had to ensure that players were working within contracts that allowed the club then to trade. So in terms of the head coach piece, the club had already done a round of interviews before I went in, and I was presented with three candidates that they wanted me to be part of the second interview for. And I'd asked to bring Yondal Thomason into then as the fourth candidate, as somebody that I'd already researched on during a previous piece of work I'd done. And I think what we had to do very clearly immediately was to ensure that we were very, very aligned in what we wanted to do. Because if we wanted a model that was based on developing players, both from our own academy, but also players that had been purchased for the club, we had to have a coach who had a track history of development and was prepared to bring in a playing style that fitted the model we believed would develop footballers, which very simply is, if you want to develop footballers, they have to have the ball. So if you're going to do that, you have to bring in a head coach who's aligned and who's demonstrated a history of that. And Yondal had done an unbelievable job at Malmo, back-to-back championships in the Swedish league, qualified for the Champions League group stages for the first, and I think I'm right saying the last of the Swedish clubs to do that as well in recent history. And by the end of the interview process, we thought he was the man who would allow that project to be driven forward. And I believe that he proved then that he was the right person for that job in terms of some of the work he did with the squad was unbelievable. And if you look at the development of players that we'd bought in, Sami Smodic obviously taking the headlines of one of those players, but also the players from the academy, Adam Wharton, Ash Phillips, etc., that then he proved to be somebody who could develop footballers, play a style of football that was very, very easy on the eye and attractive to see, and most importantly, win games as well.
Yeah, it was a pretty discernible style of play, I think, the Blackburn under Thomason. And as you mentioned there, rightly so, Adam Wharton, Ash Phillips coming through from the academy side. I just want to kind of get a read on, you know, what is your background had obviously been as an academy manager. Blackburn has always had a very good crop of young players. You know, what sort of expertise were you able to relay in your role as sporting director that helps facilitate, you know, breakthroughs of those types of players? Because I know, you know, it's not exclusively down to one person or one decision. It's an amalgamation of so many different things that makes a footballer. But, you know, to have two who were, you know, who are still very, very talented and have great ceilings, you know, to have two come through in quick succession, and you know, you're talking about alignment, your background, Yondal's, you know, experience of working with younger players when he was in Sweden, and with, you know, the as an assistant with Denmark, for example, you know, what was your specific impact and role on their sort of breakthrough?
Minimal, if I'm honest with you.
I had a feeling you might say that.
the club had obviously gone for a director of football who had an academy background. I think myself and the other candidates who were interviewed were all from a similar kind of background. So that was the first piece of work the club had done in bringing that role in. And I think in the research I'd done before starting the job, I'd watched a lot of the under-18s and the under-21 games in preparation for it. And I went in and I had five players written down that I felt could be around the first team squad that season. And literally on my first night of the job, I went out for dinner with the academy manager, Stuart Jones, Mike Sheeran, the under-21 manager, and one or two other key staff from the academy set up. And we just talked players for 3 or 4 hours, sat in an Italian restaurant in Clitheroe, throwing names around. And by the end of it, I think my list of five, one had come off and different one had gone on. But that was it, because we didn't have a head coach at that stage. So what we said was, when that group started training in pre-season, we wanted those five players around the group straight away. So when Jondal came in, those five players were already very, very close to the group. And the feedback I'd given to Jon was, I believed, and the staff believed, that we could get that group very, very close. And by the end of pre-season, Adam and Ash had done well enough that they'd broken into the 22-man squad. They'd gone beyond a group of five facilitating first-team training to becoming two core members of the first-team squad. So I think, look, we touched earlier in this conversation, youth development's a long-term journey. When I went into the club, Ash was a second-year scholar. Adam was a first-year pro. Adam had been at the club since the age of 6 or 7, Ash since 11 or 12. So many, many years of work had gone in. But I think it's also fair to say at that stage, the one bit I was able to help with was Adam as a first year. And I know you guys have already told Adam's story and had an unbelievable interview with him previously. But Adam's had found it very, very difficult as a first-year scholar, had hardly played in the under-18s. And a lot of the criticism he was getting was that he wasn't working hard enough off the ball. And I think Jondal worked really, really hard with him in that first year. And sometimes Adam didn't always see the benefit of that or understand the benefit of that. But when it clicked, it really, really clicked. And Jondal would say constantly in the press that Adam had Champions League qualities in possession. And he's able to demonstrate that now on a weekly basis for Crystal Palace. And obviously in the summer, do enough to break into the England squad. And with Ash, I think the big piece of work there then goes back to that contract piece, because he was about to go out of contract and we had to convince him to sign a contract, which allowed him to then stay at the club for at least one more year. And then hopefully the club to be able to recoup some money on the investment there as well.
Yeah, I actually remember the first time that I watched Ash Phillips. It was at the Lancashire FA ground. I mean, we were speaking about how cold it is in the UK right now. That is possibly up there with one of the coldest grounds in British football. And I remember it was an under-21s fixture, and I was just taken aback just by the sheer size and how comfortable he was. And then upon further inspection, finding out that he was only 17.
Yeah.
You know, when it comes to sort of recruitment side of things, particularly academy recruitment, you know, what are the immediate hallmarks or the factors that stand out to someone like you when you're looking at a player that you want to bring into the setup that you're working on?
I think the two or three things for me is do they have an X factor? Do they have something in one element of their game that they can be outstanding at, and then polish that to the very best of their ability? Secondly, can they dominate in 1v1 situations, either offensively or defensively? And thirdly and finally, and maybe most importantly, is their character and their resilience and their ability to learn. Those would be the two or three key things that I think you have to focus on in youth recruitment.
Is it difficult to gauge, particularly the I mean, you might call it an intangible because you can't quantify it, but is it difficult to gauge the strength of character, the strength of the resilience, how willing they are to learn when perhaps you don't have a day-to-day relationship?
In the recruitment piece, it can be quite challenging. You have to get to know them as quickly as possible.
Yeah.
If it's a player that is local and you're able to see them for 6 weeks or 12 weeks, you can get to learn that a little bit quicker. You can speak to teachers in their school and try and learn that a little bit more. If you're recruiting internationally, so if I give you an example, like someone like Adam Eder, who would have come into Norwich's system at 15, 16. Ben Strang, who was our head of academy recruitment, must have spent months and months and months working, following, tracking, watching, observing, talking to people in terms of that piece to make sure that Adam's character was the right character to bring in. Whereas if you look at someone like Johnny Rowe, Johnny was somebody we'd worked with in our development centre in Wembley for maybe a year before he joined the academy full time. So you got to learn about his character in those circumstances as well. But it is a very, very hard piece during the recruitment. It becomes easier once they're in the academy. And it also becomes easier to develop it as well, because then you can start to lay challenges down for the players. And you can deliberately try and make things challenging and hard for the players. so that they have to demonstrate resilience and learn what setbacks look like as well.
You're just moving on to sort of recruitment in a more general sense. You know, you were discussing the decision to bring Victor Boniface to Bodø/Glimt all those years ago, and obviously what he's gone on to do. You know, one of the things that I've always been really fascinated with is why sporting directors and why recruitment leads go for certain markets, or they have a preference for certain markets, or they think that in particular certain areas of the world are maybe a little bit underappreciated or looked down upon by, you know, maybe bigger clubs or clubs with greater resources. You know, how would you assess the global scouting arena, and you know, have you found that tapping into maybe underappreciated markets has benefited you in your roles?
Yeah, I think so. I think, look, it goes back to that first piece we talked about with clarity. Just I think any club in the world has limited resources. Even the biggest clubs in the world have limited resources. And especially at clubs at championship level or in the Norwegian top division, the resources are even more limited. So you've got to be very, very specific on where you spend those resources. At Norwich, we were specific not only in the boroughs that we were working in, but also in the four or five countries that we felt we could do youth recruitment on an international level on as well. We were we spent a lot of resource in Iceland, and that allowed us to bring in Christian Lindsen, who's now at Ajax, and his brother August, and other players from that market as well, who've gone on and have had good success. At Blackburn Rovers, again, we tried to focus primarily on the Championship and League One, because the easiest way of guaranteeing success in the league is if the players have already played in that league. But again, even with that piece, there's no guarantees. I've told this story before, but without wanting to bore you, just with Smodic. Smodic's record was not outstanding when he'd been in the Championship. He'd had periods where he was playing in a team that had underperformed in terms of Peterborough United. And he'd also had a period at Bristol City, which wasn't a success for him personally. And when we signed Sammy into the club, we were looking for a 10 who would add great athletic ability to the squad, but also provide a goal return as well to replace some of the goals that have been lost in the previous year. And I think what you saw with Sammy was that there was a very, very small window of games for Peterborough United, where in between managers, when Ferguson and McCann had changed in the Championship, he was trusted as a 10 rather than as a attacking midfielder coming in off the left. And in that small period of games, his performance levels from a data and also subjectively have risen dramatically. But it was a very, very small sample that you were putting your trust in.
Yeah.
And then to back that up, you had the unbelievable character references that you had on him as a human being. But it was the thought that we wanted somebody who could affect the Championship, meaning that we wanted to sign somebody who'd had Championship experience. Very much the same with the centre-back position, because we'd lost Daryl Lenihan. He'd been able to walk away from the club as a free agent. And we felt the centre-half had to be a player with Championship experience as well, hence us signing Dom Higham from Coventry City that summer. We wanted a ball-playing central defender with Championship experience. So I think the markets and understanding which markets you work in is absolutely vital.
I know that this is it's possibly not your favorite question, but you know there will obviously be occasions where you know you don't get the players that you want, or there are ones that got away. You know, are there any from your time at Blackburn that you know maybe off the top of your head you think that you know there are. That I really wish that we were able to get that player, but for X reason or Y reason, it just wasn't possible.
Yeah, a couple. There's obviously some headline ones from various January windows. I don't need to go through. I think we've been through those enough in the past to not go into that today. But I think the two that would probably jump out was the very first summer window was Seth Vandenberg, the central defender, on loan from Liverpool. He had a really good loan at Preston the year before. We felt he was very comfortable in a back four and in a back five, and gave us the athleticism that we were looking to bring in as a central defender as well. And we'd done the loan deal, agreed the personal terms, agreed the terms with Liverpool, but then Liverpool had bad injuries that summer themselves. Yeah. And they wanted to keep him around the group. And it went on and went on and went on. And I think my learning from that was we should have moved on quicker to another target, but Set was our number one target. So what that did allow was Ash Phillips then to get into the team and to play games. So it was a benefit of Set not coming into the group straight away. But that was one that I think when you look at the back end of the season and some of the goals that we conceded in the very last few games against Coventry at home and against Preston away, which eventually cost us a place in the playoffs in 22-23. I think Set might have made a difference to that and got us across the line. And the other one in that January window that year as well was Liam Delap. So Liam had a below average first loan at Stoke City in the first half of that year. Everybody could see his potential. And I think we should have moved quicker to bring him in. And I take completely responsibility for this one, to bring him in that January window. We know George Hurst was leaving the building, and I felt we should have brought, in hindsight, Liam in quicker to cover him in that position on loan, even though on the second half of the season he did go on loan to Preston and didn't play as often as he'd like to because Tom Cannon had got in the team ahead of him. But if you look at where Liam is now, I think it's no different to us. I think our model for judging centre-forwards must have been completely aligned with Ipswich Town's, because Ipswich took George Hurst off us when he came out of loan. They tried to sign Sam Gallagher, our number nine, last winter. They've eventually signed Liam Delap this summer. So in terms of that centre-forward to lead the line and to run behind and to do all the things that George and Liam and Sam do, who are all top championship centre-forwards, in my opinion, and all capable of going and playing in the Premier League, I think are aligned. So to answer your question, yeah, probably Sepp and Liam would be the two that I look back with an element of regret on.
I mean, they're two very good ones to list, because obviously, you know, anybody who has watched them over the past, you know, 12, 18 months, certainly with Liam Delap and you know, the impact that he's been able to make for Ipswich this season, I think it is really interesting to know those recruitment decisions are taking place way, way, way before, you know, anybody is you know, forecasting them to be, a breakout player in the beginning of the Premier League season, you know, 18, 24 months down the line. And, you know, that then speaks to, obviously, there will be decisions which are being made this coming January on players who are yet to, I don't know, have their breakout, but they're being discussed in the offices at various clubs. Moving on from Blackburn, obviously, you've taken the decision that you wanted to have a new challenge. Obviously, you know, you're going to experience that in the United States, which is, I'm sure, is, you know, a decision with lots of excitement and intrigue attached. What was it about MLS that made you want to go and work with Chicago Fire and the, you know, the US market in general?
I think the MLS has grown in strength enormously over the last 5 to 10 years, and whereas previously it had maybe been looked at as a club, as a league you went at to towards the end of your career, I think the last 3 or 4 years have really readdressed that. And the clubs within the league have made some really, really exciting signings. Even if you look at Chicago Fire, for example, the work that they did to bring Duran into the club and then move him onto Aston Villa, I think was exceptional work. I think the US obviously hosts the Club World Championships next summer, the World Cup the summer after that. I think you've got the best player in the world playing in the league right now as well. And like I said, I think the league has begun to do some really, really exciting recruitment work. Denki's just gone to the league himself in Belgium. I think some really, really interesting moves now, not just from European players, from South American players, but from Asian players as well. So I think the league is going from strength to strength. And I think Chicago Fire have all of the foundations in place now to be one of the top teams in the league. And I think my way of thinking about how the game should be played, how players should be developed, how to create an elite performance environment are very, very aligned with our head coach, with Greg Berhalter, who's ultimately in complete charge of the club because he holds the role of head coach and director of football. And my job is to support him across the sporting side of the football club to make sure we can be as successful as possible.
Yeah, I mean, Greg obviously has Greg Berhalter, that is, obviously has a lot of experience, you know, in a top level environment as well. What are the sort of the ambitions, you know, going into 2025 for Chicago Fire. And, you know, because obviously, as you mentioned, it's a huge, huge time for football or soccer in the US at the moment. You know, and I suppose the upside of, you know, being a team that really comes to the fore and announces themselves at that level at this time would, you know, the upside is tremendous, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. And I think, look, the ultimate aim, which again, Greg and I are completely aligned on, is that we believe we can turn Chicago Fire into one of the top football clubs in North America. Short-term aim is obviously the club hasn't made the playoffs now for a number of years. So that's something we have to strive for next year. But beyond that as well, like I said, we've got a brand new training ground opening in January. There's plans to build a new football stadium, football-specific stadium in downtown Chicago, rather than us sharing the stadium, albeit an unbelievable stadium at Soldier Field to play our home games at. But also, I think it goes back to something we've talked about a lot in this conversation in terms of the academy. Chicago is a huge market, almost 10 million people living within the city itself. No other major league club, either within Illinois as a state or within either state that lies to the east or west of it as well. So a huge potential for the academy to continue to do some of the great work that they've already started, but to be really, really proactive on player recruitment in and around Chicago to ensure that we have a good line of players developed within the club to support the first team structure as well.
Yeah, I think that final point is a really big one, especially given your expertise and experience with, you know, like you were saying, with the four or five international countries that, you know, you're scouting specifically with Norwich and the five boroughs from, you know, 10 years ago that have ultimately provided Norwich with some of their, you know, their best young players, but best players of the last decade, as well as, you know, the experience that you had at Glimt as well. Greg, I'm really, really grateful for the time that you've given up. I've been fascinated by some of the things you've had to say, and I'm sure a lot of people tuning in, both those working within football, but also those maybe hoping to get into the field of recruitment or, you know, analysis, that sort of thing. And just, you know, your football obsessives, your aficionados, I'm sure they'll have found everything you've had to say and your insights really interesting. So, yeah, thank you very much for joining.
Thanks, Joe. Really appreciate the conversation. Thank you.
And I'd also like to express a big thanks to Skill Corner, our partners, for facilitating this chat with Greg. Any clubs who are listening, who are considering getting involved in a deeper dive into sort of the data side of things, do check out Skill Corner. We've had a very, very, a huge amount of pieces on the Scouted Notebook in recent months. Backed with Skill Corner data that you simply can't get anywhere else. That has been hugely, hugely instructive and very, very helpful in terms of understanding players a lot more, understanding teams, different styles and so forth. So, very big thanks to Skill Corner for that as well. That's all from us on the Scouted podcast. I've been Joe Donoghue, joined by Greg Broughton. Thank you for listening. Bye for now. The Scouted podcast is brought to you with the support of our friends at Skill Corner, whose tracking data and performance analytics are used by many of the top clubs, leagues, and federations around the world. Covering a wide range of global competitions, Skill Corner's data helps customers to make faster, better informed decisions in recruitment, player development, and strategy. And we are now using it to support our own analysis of up-and-coming talent. For more information, visit skillcorner.com.